for a long time, if you wanted to find the innovative economy and you were sitting in a downtown, you'd get in your car and you'd drive 15 or 20 miles to a science park, and there you would see a bunch of corporate facilities, all separate, all isolated, with innovation happening in secret ways within the walls of the company. What's happening now is the spatial geography of innovation is shifting. It's almost rebalancing. And what you're seeing is an enormous amount of large companies, medium companies, small entrepreneurs, startups, scale-ups, wanting to be in the shadow of universities or around medical districts because they're sharing innovation. They're not doing it in a closed way. They're doing it in an open way. They're sort of networking research and networking discoveries for the market. So the spatial geography of innovation, what we call innovation districts, is really this mashup of companies, entrepreneurs, investors, researchers, faculty, students, all within the cores of cities and metropolitan areas, all in a very vibrant urban environment.
So we're setting at Illinois State University. A mile to the south is Illinois Wesleyan University. Between that is Advocate Broman Hospital.
Sounds like an innovation district to me.
We have the raw ingredients, it sounds like, in Bloomington Normal.
Well, I think you've got this remarkable geography where you have some of your institutional assets all close to each other, which is not that strange for a smaller city and metropolis or twin city and metropolis. And the question now is, how do you leverage those assets? You know, how do you really begin to supercharge your innovation economy, design and build your places so that they're vibrant and vital and they're almost supporting, quote unquote, the collisions between people? So you have that seamless exchange of ideas and that innovations almost occur as sort of in a routine kind of way.
How important is what you call radical mixed land use in creating innovation districts? And what role does transit, walking, and biking play in creating innovation districts? How important are those ingredients?
I think what's absolutely fundamental is to essentially go back to the future. We used to know how to build quality places in this country. Go back to the 19-teens, the 1920s. I mean, that's where you had traditional neighborhood design, the streetcars.
Sure, before the country became car-centric.
Exactly. And so this was the benefit of density. And we used to think of density as, okay, well, that'll have a benefit on consumption power and small merchants and shops. Actually, it's related to the innovative ecosystem. Because the more density you have, particularly around these institutions like a university or a hospital or a State Farm, which in our view is essentially a technology company, right? The more fermentation, the more intellectual fermentation you're likely to have, the more discoveries for the market.
Well, why do you think State Farm is a technology company, or why do you classify it as that? We think of it as an insurance company here.
Well, technology permeates all major financial institutions, insurance companies, manufacturing companies. We used to think about, you know, tech companies as essentially Facebook and Google and, you know, a couple major companies that are changing the world out of either Seattle or Silicon Valley. Actually, technology now permeates the entire American economy. And for a company to prosper, for a company to succeed, they, A, need to have constant access to talent, right? Technology talent, software talent, and they need to continuously innovate their products and their processes. Well, so it's State Farm here, it's Comcast in Philly, it's Amazon in Seattle. These are tech companies. And I think that, you know, having a company like State Farm in Bloomington Normal, along with your institutions, your universities, and so forth, is an enormous competitive advantage.
Innovation districts, of course, happen in cities. Tell me about the power of cities and why the ability to address serious issues such as climate change, income inequality, lies within cities.
Well, I think cities have to innovate and address their challenges because the national government is on a frolic and detour. I mean, Washington is not only mired in partisan rancor, and frankly, Springfield is the same. So the higher levels of government are missing in action. But also the whole nature of problem solving today. If you're going to solve a transportation problem and you went to Washington 20 years ago and you asked the Department of Transportation, what's the solution? They would say, widen a road. When you go to a city, you immediately start thinking about housing and land use and employment location and technology and sensors. It's a much more integrated response to complicated challenges. That's the nature of 21st century problem solving. It will happen in cities because cities are not governments. They're networks of public, private, and civic leaders.
Anthony Fox is certainly trying to change the culture
at
the Department of Transportation. But how can cities take the lead on infrastructure projects, say, to solve a traffic issue when the dollars are controlled federally or at the state level?
Well, I think cities are already in the lead on designing and planning and delivering. I mean, you know, I used to be the chief of staff at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and we used to say under the leadership of Henry Cisneros, we don't, as a federal department, build one house. We don't educate one child. We don't build one transit system. We just provide a platform for cities and for counties and metropolitan areas to do the hard work. I think we're going to have to find alternative financing models, frankly. And a lot of those models are coming out of Europe. In Europe, what you see in cities like Hamburg and cities like Copenhagen, it's not just the national government or even the local government financing transit in traditional ways. They're setting up publicly owned private corporations that have the power to leverage the value of public assets, particularly land and buildings, to then put towards infrastructure finance. So there are different models emerging around the world that now we need to adapt and tailor, because I don't think Washington is going to invest in the future anytime soon. Washington is essentially a healthcare company with an army, and all the other issues that matter to a modern society are being designed and increasingly financed and delivered at the local and metropolitan level.
This community just passed a half-cent sales tax, $1 million of
Perfect
that
example.
Every year goes to transit. That's a step in the direction that you're talking about.
Absolutely. And you can look, so you can do it at this level. It's what Denver is doing to build their state-of-the-art transit. It's what Los Angeles is doing. So essentially, we're changing who does what in America, partly because of partisan divisions, partly because, you know, the nature of what the national government and state government does. They essentially are supporting the elderly and the disadvantaged, which is incredibly important. But many of the other issues, investing in our children, investing in infrastructure, have become more and more local.
Partisanship does exist on the local level. It can get in the way on the local level. There have been cases of innovative comprehensive plans for communities that have been derailed by conservatives or libertarians, or transit plans to solve traffic congestion shelved because of a local tax. The issue sometimes splits along party lines. So you're not saying partisanship doesn't exist on the local level. It's just less of an issue.
I think it's less of an issue because at the end of the day, I think local people put place over party and collaboration over conflict and evidence over dogma. And everyone wants your place to be better. And I find very few people saying, we really want to go down the road of ruin. I found most people across multiple partisan and ideological spectrums saying, we want this place to be good for our children. We want it to be a competitive, a thriving, a prosperous place. Well, that just doesn't happen. You have to be intentional and purposeful about it.
Is it a revolution, or is it, as you alluded to, the cities filling a gap left by an absent government or absent central government at the state level or the federal government?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, this is a vacuum filling. And again, the national government and state governments do perform very, very important roles, and we really do want them to function. But I think we're in a different century than the 20th century. I think this is a century of open innovation, networked innovation, where essentially you need collaboration between different sectors, public, private, civic, university, community, to problem solve.
Will local municipalities pull the federal government along with them? Will the federal government step up at some point because of the innovation happening at the municipal level?
Possibly.
Or do they have to?
Well, you know, I think here's the real issue. 10 years from now, because of the rising share of elderly in our population, the federal government will spend $1.5 trillion more a year on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So to some extent, it's going to crowd out the ability of the national government to make investments in the future. So I think some of this is not just a de facto, sort of devolution of responsibility. I think this is a structural shift of who does what in this country. I really do hope that the pragmatism and affirmative energy and future-oriented nature of cities begins to affect the discourse in Washington.
I'm curious what you think about cities and social issues and if they're self-regulating on those social issues without a federal government. And I think of Cleveland and Tamir Rice, Michael right. Brown and Ferguson, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, or issues over prayer or sexuality or gender. It seems to me that cities can lead in these areas, but sometimes need to be led. And I wonder what you think about cities and social issues and the role of the federal government.
Well, again, I think we've had a long history of almost institutional racism in the United States. And many of those examples you just cited in Cleveland and Ferguson and Baltimore are examples of that. And so we've inherited some very complicated issues and stress points in our society. We also have an economic restructuring that are leaving tens of millions of Americans with wages that are not sufficient to make, to basically move ahead. So the national government is really critical to both to make work pay, to invest in innovation so that we can actually build an economy with more, better quality jobs, to sort of regulate some of these racial and ethnic tensions we have in a diversifying economy and society. But at the end of the day, it happens in a place. It doesn't happen in an abstract bureaucracy or courtroom. And therefore, I think we need to have, sort of a bigger notion of subsidiarity, problem solving closer to the problem.
Bruce Katz, thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Bruce Katz is the Centennial Scholar at the Brookings Institution and author of The Metropolitan Revolution. He spoke this morning at the McLean County Regional Planning Commission's 11th Annual Community Information Forum. You're listening to Sound Ideas.